Welcome to Cloud Native Startup. I'm Emily O'Meara, your host, and today I'm chatting with Laurent Zhu, who is one of the founders of Cast AI. Laurent, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me, Emily.
So I like to start by just getting a little bit of an introduction and a background, and you have a long list, actually, of companies that you've founded. So introduce us to them and your entrepreneurial resume, I suppose.
Thank you. Cast AI is actually the fourth company that I'm doing with actually the same founders. So we know each other for a long, long time now. We started by starting something in the Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, a company called Vudel. It was later acquired by Google in 2012. Vudel was applying artificial intelligence for computational photography. So we would make face recognition, object detection in videos or in picture. It was the early days of using the terms AI. Actually, I think I never ever mentioned the word AI at Vudel. It was more about machine learning. There was no hype at the time. We were one of the first to use GPUs for computational work. That was the pioneer time. Like, we would do this on the mobile phone. The mobile phone would get so hot by using the GPU that you had probably an hour of battery and then it would go down. So that was really early days of computational photography and face recognition. Fantastic ride at Google. Then we thought with the same founder, we thought we could apply the same techniques for cybersecurity. You see, we had developed some, I don't want to say expert, but we know a thing or two about AI and machine learning. We thought maybe there is some very interesting problems to solve by looking at patterns in big files. And that's where typically our big amount of data, that's where typically AI is useful sometimes. So we started a company called ZenEdge. ZenEdge was later acquired by Oracle, and we became part of Oracle Security for Oracle Cloud. So also a great time at Oracle. I enjoyed my 2 years there. It's a fantastic company. They actually did an incredible, powerful cloud. A few people believed it at the time, but they really became one of the top four, top five player in the cloud. Enterprise cloud in particular. So a great time at Oracle. And the reason why we did Cast AI is very simple. When we were at ZenEdge, we started to spend, a few thousand dollars on Amazon, like all startups probably do, AWS. And 3 years later, by the time we got acquired, that became $2 million. And that's, by far was our number one expense in the company. And so we thought, what can we do about this? Like, are we spending the right amount? Should this be higher or lower than $2 million? There was very little help from the cloud providers or from other organizations to say, hey, is that the right number? So we thought, when we could be free again, and after 2 years at Oracle, we thought, let's solve that problem once and for all. Let's not be frustrated anymore by cloud spend. Let's see if you can use and apply some machine learning techniques to better understand how much you spend on one side, and then also how much you should really spend on the other side, and then try to find some automation that brings you to the optimized state of only spending what you need or what you should, nothing less and nothing more. And yep, that was 2 years ago, and that became Cast AI.
Fabulous. So many questions. My first is, so you're French, and how did you end up starting a company in Ukraine?
Oh, it's always the luck and meeting people, interesting people. In my case, it was having a coffee in Paris with a friend of mine. And the friend of mine told me there is this incredible entrepreneur that is thinking of doing something in the Ukraine to use some of these very talented mathematical experts in the country. And the next day I was in Kiev. And that's how it happened. We did fundraising in Silicon Valley and in California, as always. We tried in Europe, by the way. That was early days, 2007, 2008. And for European VCs, they were saying, where is Ukraine? Like, it's too far away from Paris or from London or from Berlin. Like, we were rejected almost every time. And in California, everything was cool. Oh, you're in Ukraine. That's great. There's so many talented people there. Yeah, we have them all. And that's how we did the Series A. And then the Series A became a Series B, and then a Series C, and then an acquisition.
So tell me more about this coffee in Paris. I'm always interested in knowing what was the moment that you decided to take the jump and start a company.
It's because of, I think, the person. So I met one of my friends was a lawyer, and his friend was an entrepreneur called Yuri Freeman. Yuri was just exited as a CEO of a public company. and was trying to think how he can apply his talent into starting small business and developing them as startups. And that's exactly what happened. We clicked on, you know, in the first 5 minutes, we discussed our passion, our vision, how we could change the world by using these computational photography techniques. That was just an idea, right? We didn't have the napkin to write it, to write it on, but that was just an idea. And he knew some super talented professor in a university in Kiev that had developed incredible machine learning techniques to detect objects in videos and pictures. So we thought, yeah, that's incredible. I mean, imagine this. If you point your phone to a friend of you and the phone says, this is your friend, and therefore you can share that picture with that person, how cool that is. And that's what we thought we would be able to achieve one day. You know, it's interesting. Everybody told us it's impossible. This is before Facebook had face recognition, right? This is the early days of this idea that pictures can tell you a story. And the story depends on who is on the picture and who you're taking a picture from. So that's how it happened. We had this coffee discussion. I think it was a 5 minute thing that became a few hours. Then Yuri told me he has a flight to Kiev the next day. Then I say, fine, I'll book my ticket too and we'll meet there. And that's what happened. I never left. And Yuri and I, we did this all these other things together after that.
Excellent. And what do you think that you learned in that first startup that you didn't do again, shall we say, in the subsequent ones?
Oh, it's not really didn't do again. It's more, you know, in the early days when you have a great idea, you believe in it with a lot of passion. It's okay that you change your ideas and you make adjustments. It's called a pivot. There is even a name for it. But it's never okay to give up on it. And you know, when we got this rejection from many VCs in Europe, again, the industry at the time was not very developed there. It got there eventually. Being rejected is tough because you take it, you know, in your face, right? It's a slap in the face. They are telling you, oh, you're not good enough, or you don't have the experience, or we don't think, you know, Kiev is not stable, or whatever. They don't know the place. It's too far away from, you know, it's not an hour drive to see the company. So there was a lot of things that made this difficult in the beginning. And not giving up, I think, is the most important in our life, in the entrepreneur especially. You're going to have a lot of people that will tell you how bad this idea is. And you know, the more people who say that, the better it is for you, because it means you're the only one who can think you can do the impossible. But Yuri and I, we speak of this, my other co-founders, we speak of this very often, how many times people told us that what we were doing was impossible. It was a bad thing and would never happen. And the more we hear this, the more it makes us want to do it. But sometimes it's tough, right? It's not easy to stomach this rejection from very smart people. I mean, these are VCs, right? They are professional investors. So they must know a few things that we don't know. So yeah, that's I think that's the biggest, the biggest thing is believe your idea, you know, believe it with your passion. It's okay to change mind. In fact, you should change mind as often as required and necessary. Sometimes you don't even notice that you're changing mind. The company is smoothly sailing and looking for product market fit. That's normal. We all went through this, but don't give up on it. I think that's what is the most important. Keep the passion. Don't give up on it. Believe that you can do it, and also bring this passion to your team members, because at the end of the day, you can't do it alone, and you have to have a great team of people that share the same will and the same ideas that you do.
And what do you think was sort of the most challenging moments? I'm actually curious to know, in each startup, like, what was the moment in each that was the most challenging?
In my case, was our Series B. We get a term sheet, we sign the term sheet, and the investor doesn't show up. That happened to us once. And believe me, when that happened, we didn't have a plan B, right? I mean, we were set. The investor was in Asia. He was a strong person, wealthy individual that did professional investment, running his own family office. He signed the term sheet. He did not invest. That's, you know, that's the end of the world in this case. We got lucky. We rebounded. We find a very great partnership with another fund in California that understood this. And yeah, sometimes it happens. These are setbacks. And as I said, we didn't give up on it. We had a month that was difficult because that month we didn't know what direction we were going to be able to do. And we got a term sheet. And I remember this was in August, we learned that it was not going to happen. And in September, we got a term sheet for Series B and with great investors that came. Qualcomm was one of them. And it's Best Buy was another one. There was a semiconductor company that also decided to invest in us. So it was fantastic at the end, but it was very bumpy to get there. So yeah, you have to be ready to have these things. You have to communicate to your team. You can't take secret. You have to be transparent. Everybody has to know the reality of it. And if you have a solid team and if you all believe in the same things, then you always overcome these bumps. And that's what happened to us. I think it happened to the first one. It never happened after that, probably because, well, we learned a few things and these mistakes for sure. And also being a repeat entrepreneur means that the second company is a lot easier than the first. And the third one and the fourth one is a lot easier also.
Tell me a little bit about staying with the same co-founder. How does one make that work? And in fact, how common is it for that to happen among people that you know?
Yeah, I actually don't know anybody like this. We are just a group of people that know each other so well. We know the weakness and we know the strong points. Yuri Freeman is our CEO. Leon Kuperman is our CTO. Inaris Gravrock is also with us. So, you know, we know each other so well that we know we can almost finish the sentences of each other at sometimes. So there is this level of complicity and understanding between each other. We identify opportunities. We know how to communicate them. Of course, there are also bumps. It's normal. We're all human. We sometimes don't think the same. But at the end of the day, Yuri is our CEO and co-founder, and we go with the decision he makes, and we all respect that, and we respect each other. I think that's what matters.
Are there secrets to making that happen? I mean, it's kind of like a marriage. There has to be some best practices.
I don't know. I don't know if there is anything to learn from it. It really is this, you know, we understand each other. We all have good things and we know where we need help, where we help each other. One can handle the other one when we have an issue to solve somewhere else. So it really is this understanding, the human nature understanding of each other that matters most. Some of us are technical, others are not technical, and that's perfectly fine. We run a business, we sell to humans, you know, we don't sell to machines. So being non-technical, sometimes it's great when you talk to a human about your ideas and your product. So yeah, I don't think there's a recipe. I think it's almost like you're getting friends and you like to work with friends, and that's when the magic happens.
Do you think there is anything, you know, particularly unique about having a technical product that's sold to technical people? I do feel like a lot of people get really hung up on that developers or that engineers are somehow different from other consumers. And I'm just curious sort of what your take is on that.
I don't feel it's different. So there's a few principles that we have that we follow, and we're not the only one. A lot of people in this conference are the same. Number one is simplicity. So yes, the product is technical, but that's not an excuse to make the product complicated. Complicated doesn't mean that the product doesn't do complex things. It just means that it does complex things in a very simple way so that the user can handle it easily and with a little friction. So that's all about the product we do. You know, Apple says they do beautiful products, and I think they're right. We have to do beautiful product, and beautiful for developers means simple. That's my opinion. That's our principle is if you cannot show something, then it doesn't exist. So if you're not able to demo in a simple way, if you cannot explain the value in 2 or 3 minutes, then it doesn't exist. If you keep following this, then you will end up doing some very simple, easy explanation. It's simple to use, even though it's very technical in matter. It's for Kubernetes that just this word is very complex to explain, but it does a very simple thing. We optimize your application for cost. That's what we do. We make them cheaper to run. And we can show this in a minute. And we made sure that you can do this with a click of a button. And yeah, what it does once you click the button is very difficult and complex, but that's fine. That's because it's a product for developers for making applications simpler or cheaper. But we made the message easy, simple. It's easy to try. It's easy to to have a proof of concept. We have instant gratification. So you click on that button, you'll see your costs for running this application decrease immediately. Like in 5 minutes, your cost may just be half what it was before. Doesn't matter if this application have 100,000 CPUs or 20 CPUs. We tried both cases. I mean, 100,000 is crazy. We did see this in Kubernetes. And yes, the product behaves the exact same way. And it's the same button that you have to click to reduce your cost. So I don't want to say we have the recipe. That's who knows. But I think making things simple is a great principle to help communicate the message. And eventually, you know, as founders, we love when people use our product. And it's an incredible feeling when you see someone come to you, see you in the booth and say, oh, I've been using you guys for months and it's great. And, you know, that's why we did this. And this is made possible by making things simple so someone can try it easily.
Yeah, listeners or frequent listeners will recognize that one of the things I advocate is making your value clear in 2 or 3 minutes. I talk about that all the time.
And you're right to say it.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you know, developers, like all people, they want to know what they're going to get out of it. And then potentially they might care how you achieve it, but they will only care after they understand what that value is.
Yeah, I think also developers are very analytics. They have an analytic mind. I think I understand why we all were developers. Well, I was a long time ago. So if you are transparent, you show the gratification, if you show immediately what will happen once they use it, and then if when they use it, what you say would happen really do happen in reality, that's when you win this. That's when you win them. You win them not because your product is shiny and beautiful. You win them because you have done what you said you would, and you have said that in a few minutes, as you mentioned, and you're able to achieve that as fast as that, right? I think that's the recipe. In our case, that's the recipe that works.
Yeah. No unpleasant surprises. Say what you're going to do and do it. Yeah, that's very true. What would you say is some things that have been unexpected, even as a repeated entrepreneur? Like, what are things that have come up at Cast AI that maybe didn't happen in your earlier startups?
Oh, yeah, there, of course, it's very often very specific. At Cast AI, we actually changed the product twice already. Change is the wrong word. We smoothly improved the product in a direction that we didn't know would be the direction when we started the company. So in the beginning, we thought that the great thing with containers is they can run in any place. They can, in particular, run in multiple clouds. That's why we all love containers. It's not the only reason, but it's one of them. So they are independent to where they run for the most part. So we thought a great idea would be, hey, why don't we tell our developers, you can run this container in Google or on Amazon, and maybe it will be cheaper on Amazon than it will be on Google. Or maybe you can run a piece on Amazon and a piece on Google and the third piece on Azure, and you let an AI engine decide that for you because there are so many price difference between the cloud provider. If eventually you can do this, you can really do an arbitrage between the cost of using compute instance on Amazon, Google, and Azure. And the prices are very different between cloud providers. The services are different too, but the price for the same compute can go from 1 to 2, depending on which cloud provider you select, but not for all the instances. There are some that are cheaper on Amazon, some other that are more cost-effective on Google in certain cases. So that was the idea we had, is why don't we make Kubernetes autonomous and have an engine that decide where, you know, you break these containers into small pieces and you run them in the pieces there that is best for them to run from a cost perspective. That was a great idea, but we find out that the multi-cloud concept was still too advanced for many of our customers. So multi-cloud is a great name, but most of the time you achieve multi-cloud by accident. It just means someone is using Google on one side and another team may use Azure on the other side. And because these two teams don't talk to each other, suddenly you become multi-cloud. There are companies that have multi-cloud as a strategy. Often it's not a strategy, it's just a fact of life. We find out that, in fact, cost optimization on one cloud only is almost as effective as it is on more than one cloud. A lot of our clients now are happy to use Amazon, or they're happy to use Google and happy to use Azure, and they're happy to stay where they are. And we show them they can reduce their cost by 75% by staying inside Amazon. And it's great. There's no need to go into the neighboring cloud to achieve these savings. Yes, it's a little bit better if you add another one, but it's not required, and you already receive these incredible savings by staying on AWS or by staying on Google or on Azure. So that's something we didn't plan for. We thought multi-cloud was the answer because of this arbitrage. We ended up looking and seeing that even on one cloud, you have this incredible pocket of optimization, and these pockets are so huge that it's a lot better for the client because then it's frictionless. We're not telling them you have to change cloud provider. We're telling them we're going to make it so efficient where you are, and we're not going to change anything to your application. You just will happen to use less machines because it doesn't need to. So that's one of the pivot. And even pivot is a big word. Let's say that all these techniques we develop in the context of independent from a cloud provider, we find out that they apply to one cloud, and it's extremely powerful to be on one cloud. So that's the selling that you have to do as you are running a startup. You have to identify your product market fit. And in our case, that was a journey.
And how did you figure, how did you come to that conclusion that perhaps it would be better experience for your customers if you're just focused on optimizing the one single cloud?
Because the customers told us.
Did you ask them or did they just tell you?
No, they told us. They said, no, this is great that we'd love to use Google and Azure at the same time, but you know what? Can you do that on Google? And after a few times, you start feeling maybe that's it, right? Oh, yeah. It's extremely powerful to stay inside your cloud provider and you will still see 75% cost reduction. Let's enjoy and do it. And so that's how the product market fit happened. And it's been great. You know, we ourselves were surprised by the level of interest we got from the marketplace. There's two things from this. One is it's completely frictionless. As I was saying earlier, right, the simplicity of things. It is frictionless. Imagine this. You come to see me, and I will tell you, look, in 30 seconds, I'm going to tell you how much you're going to save. And in 5 minutes, you will get there. And you have two buttons to click. For large enterprise, it takes longer. But for the typical company that comes to KubeCon, that's exactly how it is. You click on one button, you get your savings report. So it's a provision of savings. You click on the second button, and then suddenly there is some automation powered by an AI engine that will move you from your current configuration to an optimized configuration smoothly. You can do this in minutes. You can do this in a day. You can actually control the timing you want this movement to happen. The interest of this took us by surprise. We thought, I mean, we've been there many times, right? The product market fit is something central to all the companies we've done before. This one was much faster than we have ever experienced before because of this frictionless, this simplicity that we have, the instant information that we give you about where you spend money today and how much you should really spend based on what your application is doing.
So what do you actually think a product market fit means? It's a term people talk about, but it's a little squishy. So how would you define it?
Yeah. So there are two words in the product market fit. Three words. There is a product, there is a market, and it has to fit to each other. It's a very fuzzy feeling. So you never know. You're never sure about it. But what it means is you have a product that people want. That's when you have a product market fit. If they really, really want it and they can't do without it, that's when you know you are into something. So that's what happened to us. And the product is never the one you always think it should be. In our case, that was clear as well, right? The minute we did a version for AWS, that was the first one we did. Then we did Google and we did Azure. The minute we did the one for AWS and we started to show these to AWS users, it was instant. Say, oh, can we try? Can we do a POC? Can you show me how I save the money? Can you show me what happened when I click on the button? There was no button at the time, right? So that's when you feel, there is a product that is very appealing to a lot of different type of companies, different type of teams. That's when it starts to smell really good. And it's not even that you need to constantly look for it. You know when it happens. You know it. You start to feel, well, last week I had two meetings. This week I have five. Right, something is happening there. And all the five meetings are all about the same thing. They're all using Amazon. They all have a problem with cost, and they all love the idea that they can do it frictionless on their Kubernetes cluster. Then the next week, we have more and then more and more. Of course, in the beginning, things are never as fast and smooth as you can, as you think. You know, the product is an MVP. It has to be an MVP enough so you can go to the next step. You have to find customers that can be partners. We were lucky to find one like this fantastic company in a tech business in the Bay Area that said, "Now we know your product is being there, but we really like what you do, that we want to do it with you together." So when you find your customer that becomes your partner, your design partner in the next step of that the feature of the product will be, that's when it starts to feel really, really nice. And this is when you start to think of increasing or having a more professional sales team. Exactly what happened to us. In July, we had, I think, one or two salesperson. Now we have 12. And that's 3 months later, right? Because we can, because they have things to do, because there is so many inbound and outbound activity happening to us that you feel it's the moment to accelerate. And then it's exactly when we did our Series A that we announced it 2 days ago. But it happened at that moment when we started to see this customer sales motion, this motion where a customer would come in immediately wanting to do a POC. A few days later, loving the result of what they were saying, we thought, let's just increase now. Let's go faster than we initially thought. We thought we would do a Series A, in 2022. We did it 6 months earlier because that allowed us to accelerate our sales marketing activity. So there is no recipe, but whenever you launch a product and you listen very carefully to what the customer are doing and the comments they are giving to you, you make adjustment in the direction of these comments, and then you start to see suddenly a sudden increase of activity. Whether these are questions from your clients or proof of concept or sometimes individual members, DevOps people that says, "Hey, we heard about you guys. Can we try something there?" That's when it feels great.
Excellent. And for listeners, I know, Laurent, you were talking about, you know, people who want the product. And just to, I'm pretty sure you all agree with this, but it's not just people in general, but a very specific type of person who have a specific type of characteristics.
Yeah, that's the other component that's very important in the product market fit is knowing to who are you selling to and who are the users. And often they are the same person. The user is a buyer. Then it's really great when that happens. In our case, the user are DevOps managers, head of teams, individuals, sometimes CTOs on smaller companies. But it's always the people that are concerned with having an application run smoothly. It's always the number one concern. The second concern is, how much are we spending for this? And typically, these are the persona that will think of these problems, DevOps managers or CTOs. So having the right persona is very important. But you know, it's not very difficult. These are the natural users. And so again, right, there's no recipe for product market fit, but you feel it. It's a very natural process to show, hey, this is what we do. What do you think? And those that say something will be these people. So it's a little bit of discovery, but it's a very natural process of listening to what they say.
Excellent. Before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to add?
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed this conversation. So Emily, thank you so much for inviting me. And look, if anybody in the audience have questions, you can reach me. My email is laurent@cast.ai. So it's very easy, very simple. LAURENT. I really enjoy the feedback, the comments, and please, 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 as a founder, if some of you guys that are listening are using our product, let me know. Drop me a note. There's nothing more pleasant and really cool than having people using what we've been working very hard for the last 2 years. So if you have any comment and ideas and sometimes critics, what we do, it's always a pleasure to listen to you.
Excellent. Well, you actually already answered what's usually my last question about how people should get in touch. But anything else or how people should follow or get in touch?
One more thing I want to say. We were fortunate to meet a super talented group of people out of Lithuania. in Vilnius. And we have a big team of developers over there. We have 40 people in Vilnius, in Lithuania. We did the same for my previous company. There are so many talented people in Vilnius that every time I go there, because during COVID, I couldn't do that too often, but every time I go there, it's a pleasure to see them. The magic happened there. The management team is in the US, of course, self-marketing. Some executive guys are here. But the team we have, the amazing, talented group of engineers that are developing, that are inventing, is based in Vilnius, in Europe. And I recommend, like, everybody who wants to go and start something in Lithuania, please let me know. We know a lot of people there and very, very talented people in Lithuania. So it's a small country. It's a fantastic place to be.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.